Well, good afternoon again. Welcome back to Midday, our second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks for joining us. So this agitated guy walks into a psychiatrist's office and tells the receptionist, "I gotta see a shrink. I think I'm invisible." The receptionist knocks on the doctor's office and says, "There's a patient out here who says he's invisible." And the doctor says, "Tell him I can't see him." Good joke, bad joke. There's no way a comic can tell until he tries it out, until he tries out that punchline on a live audience. Even then, the pros are often surprised at what makes people laugh and what doesn't. Our next guest says there's a good reason for this. While many animals laugh, we humans are unique in our ability to tell jokes and to appreciate them. Scott Weems, a psychologist and a neuroscientist, has spent years studying the science of when we laugh and why. In fact, that's the subtitle of a fascinating new book whose answers to these questions may surprise you. Laughter, he writes, is a natural reaction to confusion caused by complex and conflicting messages in a brain where chaos often reigns. When our expectations are rudely jostled by a well-crafted punchline, say, a surprise, we may chuckle or laugh out loud or even groan. It results from a battle in our brains between feelings and thoughts, Scott Weems writes. It's a coping mechanism, a way of dealing with conflict. And under the right circumstances, almost anything can make us laugh. Scott Weems says we laugh, you may be surprised to hear this, 15 to 20 times a day. Women tend to be more open to humor than men, but women tend to laugh less as they get older. Scott Weems also cites studies showing that laughter may indeed be the best medicine. It's been shown to improve heart health, boost the immune system, and even lower glucose levels in diabetics. Why did I find that was that funny? That's good news. Scott Weems is a graduate. We haven't even got started yet, and I'm laughing. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do this. Scott Weems is a graduate of the Coast Guard Academy up in New London, Connecticut. He served on a cutter in Alaska before returning to academe, where he topped off graduate degrees in psychology, education, and creative writing with a PhD in cognitive neuroscience from UCLA. He's adjunct research scientist at the Center for Advanced Study of Language at the University of Maryland College Park. His first book is entitled, Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. It's available from Basic Books. Scott Weems, excuse me for laughing already, but welcome to Midday on WYPR Baltimore.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
So, Scott, let's jump right in here. What made you write this book? Did you hear a particularly good joke one night and decide to find out why that was so funny?
I think I'm like everybody else in that I enjoy humor. I mean, I enjoy watching comedies, and just humor is an important part of my life. And so, I mean, that's the personal side of it. But then there was the professional side of it just always amazed me that, at least in academia, it's not very much of a respected or research topic, which bothered me in graduate school. I just didn't have the nerve to make that my dissertation because I wanted to get a job one day. It's just it's hard enough to get grant money and topics people take seriously. But it was always something I read about, I followed, and was very close to what I specialized in, which was creativity and languages, these other very important and broad topics. But the longer I was in the field, the longer I saw that humor overlaps with everything, which is why I think it's so important. It's really closely linked with intelligence and insight and language. And I think when we understand humor, we will really understand almost everything about ourselves.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the thesis behind your book, that laughter, as I was trying to describe it there and I started chuckling, that laughter is the result of some very complex things going on in our brain having to do with conflict and the effort to resolve conflict or deal with surprise. So give us the big overview of that.
Sure. I mean, it really comes down to the idea that our brains are very complex machines. And we've all heard this. We know, you know, you hear the anecdote, it's the most complex machine in the world. And obviously it is. But the thing is, it's not like a computer. A computer is relatively straightforward. There's a central processing unit, and it oversees everything. And if it gets confused, if a computer is overwhelmed, it just shuts itself down, or it gives you the blue screen of death, or whatever, and you have to reboot it. this is completely different than the way the brain works. It's more like an anarchy. There's no central processor, and it doesn't have the liberty to just shut itself down if things get confusing. We have to plug on. And so a lot of the world is confusing. Jokes are confusing at first. And, I mean, you can choose like a Groucho Marx line. It's just a quick and pithy example. The classic line, "Yesterday I shot an elephant in my pajamas. How I got on my pajamas, I have no idea." I use the line, and I love that line because in just a very short sentence, your brain is just doing somersaults. At first, you're imagining Groucho in pajamas, and then an elephant, and then there's this awkward point in the middle where you're not sure what to make of what he's saying. And, I mean, that's you get that very quick in a joke, but you get that all the time, and sometimes not just in structured jokes, and that's why we laugh at a lot more than just humor in a very formal sense.
You know, it's hard to get ivory in Africa, but in Alabama, the Tuscaloosa. That's also from
you
Groucho.
You know the follow-up? That's amazing. I've never met anybody that knew the follow-up line to the Groucho Marx bit, but yeah.
That's from his Captain Spaulding bit, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. He actually only gave, I think they actually tried to search down where that came from, and he only used the line twice. And the first time, the kind of quintessential example, he followed up with the Tuscaloosa.
Scott, from all your research, all this poking around that you did, so there's a part of the brain that's responsible for managing conflict. And you talk in your book about overriding the false expectations required by many jokes, just as you demonstrated there.
Yeah, absolutely. That's when you're surprised. To be surprised, really, you've got to have some sort of expectation that all of a sudden you're shocked out of.
Mm-hmm.
So in our Groucho Marx line, that expectation is that Groucho is wearing pajamas. And there are ingredients for humor. I like to say there are no rules for humor. If there were, then we would have figured it out a long time ago. But there are certainly ingredients. And one of them is that you need to have some sort of expectation and then be shocked out of it, which is why you think of the old Jay Leno stand-up bits where he take misworded newspaper headlines. And nobody's really going to laugh at the headline, "Lawyer Testifies in Suit." It's ambiguous, but you might laugh at "Lawyer Testifies in Horse Suit."
Mm-hmm.
Why? Why is that one funny? You might not laugh out loud. It's maybe chuckle-worthy.
Oh, I love those things. Yeah, I love those things.
But it's better if you're going for humor because you've got an expectation and then you've got a new destination too, and you've got to have both. And without that, you just get ambiguity, which isn't enough to get a laugh.
Tell us about the research and how you went about yours and what you the research that you use for the book. I know a lot of in most other fields of neurology and psychology, a lot of insight comes from brain scans, right? You use that method as well.
I do. I come to the field from a cognitive neuroscience standpoint, which means I'm interested in psychology, but particularly in a very brain-based sort of way. So whenever I take a problem like humor, the first thing I want to do is I want to understand what do we mean by humor when we're talking about what happens in the brain. And things, how issues like creativity and language, how do they come from this amazing machine? And for example, like with humor, of course, it's simplifying to say it's only one region. Of course, the whole brain is involved in humor. But there's one region that's very important, and it's called the anterior cingulate. It's kind of beneath the surface. And I think what's amazing about that is this region clearly isn't just used for humor. It's used for a lot. And one of the things it's used for is dealing with conflict. So if you hear something that you don't understand at first, or you're getting conflicting ideas on how you should respond. And in laboratories, you can look at this very specifically. But we get this all the time in just society. We just aren't sure how to take something. These are the kind of things that our anterior cingulate has kind of evolved to deal with. And over time, we've co-opted it to be important for humor, too, because that's what we're doing. We're confused and working through these issues very quickly with humor.
Okay. So answer this question, then. Some people are said to have a better sense of humor than others, right? Oh, he's got a great sense of humor. Oh, she's got a great sense of humor. To distinguish he or she from other people we know who either don't get jokes, don't tell jokes, aren't very funny, don't own ducks, just not funny people. So take me back to the anterior cingulate, if you will, and answer my question about why some people seem to have a better sense of humor than others.
Yeah, I mean, you've really touched on an important topic there, which is humor is amazingly idiosyncratic. I mean, what you might find hilarious, I might find grossly offensive, or vice versa. How do you explain that? On one level, it's just we're all different personalities. We all have different tastes. For all of us, I would say we all have the same basic brain mechanisms underlying humor. So it's all a matter of conflict. But just like in real life, what might cause you conflict and a pleasant resolution for you might lead to conflict and just utter horror for someone else. And you asked earlier where did the idea for the book come from me. And if I were to isolate it to a single incident, my wife isn't happy I share this, but since we lived in Baltimore, I have to embarrass her and share that she laughed at the end of Titanic when Leonardo DiCaprio is drowning. And
he's
and
a popsicle, basically.
He's a popsicle. And yeah. Everybody, I mean, anybody who, I guess the movie came out in 99, anyone who saw the movie then, I mean, the theater was filled with tears. And I looked over to my wife, and she was laughing and trying desperately to hold it in because my parents were there, too.
Really?
And I'm like, why are you laughing? And she whispered in my ear, and she just said, "Yo, Adrian," which is just
from Rocky?
From Rocky. Technically, I had
Yo,
to do
Adrian,
some
I'm a popsicle.
I'm a popsicle.
I'm sorry.
She had channeled Rocky 3, not even Rocky 1, Rocky 3, where he's in Siberia. And,
yeah.
And,
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then here comes Adrian across the snow, and they're
right.
All freezing.
It's like a Dr. Zhivago scene.
Yeah, in a very dark way, right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, she was the only person in that room, except for maybe me. I'm not moved by that kind of movie, but that's probably why we're married. But, I mean, for what people found sad, she found this contradiction, which is that James Cameron, the director, was dealing with the climax in that movie the same way he did with Aliens and Terminator, this just with nonstop fury. It was just a different kind of emotion than experience and with these other movies. And so she rebelled, as she often does. And this is why we all laugh at different things, because what causes a conflict in a pleasant way for some might lead to completely different response for someone else.
Scott, we're going to listen now to famous comedian Henny Youngman. And I want you to listen to a little bit of this. We just have an excerpt from one of his stand-up routines. And then we'll talk a little bit about what the magic was here with Henny Youngman, why the people in this audience are laughing, why we all still, many of us, laugh at good old Henny Youngman.
I want to tell you, people are mixed up. I came out of the Carnegie Deli in New York, and a panhandler walked up. He said, "I haven't eaten in 2 days. I said, "You should force yourself." Any Italians here tonight? I love the Italian people. During World War II, an Italian girl saved my life. She hid me in her cellar. It was in Toronto. I feel good. I met a wonderful doctor. He gave a guy 6 months to live. Couldn't pay his bill, gave him another 6 months. The man said, "Doctor, I'm having trouble home with my love life. What should I do?" He said, "Take off 20 pounds, run 10 miles a day." Man calls him 2 weeks later. "Doc, took off the 20 pounds. I've been running 10 miles a day." He says, "How's your love life?" "I don't know. I'm 140 miles away." "Doctor, put a stethoscope to my heart." I said, "Doc, how do I stand?" He said, "That's what puzzles me." "Doctor said to me, get undressed." I said, "Take me out a few times first." I'm standing there with no clothes on. The doctor said, "Go over that window, stick your tongue out." I said, "But what is that? I'm mad at my neighbor." I said, "Doc, I got shingles. He tried to sell me aluminum siding."
This is a true story. I was once in Logan Airport, Boston, waiting for tickets. This is a long time ago. Henny Youngman was in line with the rest of us, and the line was moving slowly. And he actually had the violin case under his arm. He was carrying his violin. And he was getting impatient with everyone else waiting for the tickets, our tickets. And he yelled to the woman at the counter, the attendant, "Is there a movie on this? Are you showing a movie on this line while we wait?" He just couldn't resist telling jokes. Everybody recognized him. What was going on there? What would you say about Henny Youngman jokes and people's reactions to those?
Oh yeah, I mean Henny Youngman. He's a classic. I mean, I challenge anyone else to be able to tell the "Take My Wife, Please" joke that he he's most famous for. It's so special. You know, one interesting thing about him is that kind of humor you don't see so much now.
No.
And humor really says a lot about the time. Henny Youngman was the quintessential comedian of his era, 60 years ago now or so, I guess?
Yeah, he's been gone a while.
Yeah. But
I mean, all through the 40s, 50s, 60s, up through the 80s, I think Henny Youngman was around, yeah.
And a genius. And I love him for that. But you look at who's who's the top comedian? Who's that person today? And maybe Louis C.K. is. I don't know, Amy Schumer maybe. But I think the most interesting thing I take from somebody like him is you can learn so much about what people were like at that time. And an easier, more distinguishable example is something like Robin Williams' comedy 30 years ago. No one could get away with that now. It's a much more subdued, direct, honest kind of comedy we get today. And I'd say maybe that's what distinguishes today's humor, even maybe from Henny Youngman's time, is we expect our comedians to be personal. I think that's why people like Louis C.K. are considered to be, you know, at the top of the game now, is because you feel like you know them at the end of the jokes. Henny Youngman was just a genius because he could pull off those one-liners, and I could think of maybe Mitch Hedberg and a couple of others that do that now or have done that recently, but they're rare.
Scott, we'll take our first break here. We'll come back and talk some more about humor. Scott Weems joining us in this hour of midday on WYPR, neuroscientist and adjunct research scientist at the University of Maryland College Park. His book is Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. More about what's going on in our brains when we laugh when we get back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here. Our guest this hour is Scott Weems, who spent considerable time at the University of Maryland College Park, now joining us from Arkansas. His book is Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. It turns out laughter, humor, is a very complex process that depends on the chemicals floating around in our brains, how our neurons are wired, and how we react to confusing and conflicting messages, all of which you'll find packaged into a good joke. We're going to talk to Scott about what makes a good joke. Here's a pretty good joke. A screwdriver walks into a bar. The bartender says, "Hey, we have a drink named after you." A screwdriver looks at the bartender and says, "You have a drink named Murray?" All right, back to Scott here. Back to Scott. What does make a good joke, Scott? Yeah, you broke that down in the book.
Yeah, you got me to laugh on that. I like that one. I hadn't heard that one before.
You hadn't heard that one? It's usually a grasshopper, isn't it? I usually heard that. A grasshopper walks into a bar. Anyway, Scott, So break it down. What does make a good joke? There's like three elements that you point to in the book.
Yeah, I mean, there's kind of three phases that we go through when processing a joke, and I'd say if you're missing any one, you're gonna fall flat. The first one, we talked about this a little bit already. I call it constructing, but I mean, you can use any term you want. It's the idea of building an expectation. And so, I mean, that grasshopper joke is great because you figure it's got to be about the grasshopper, you know, the name, and then, you know, just goes a totally different direction. And people can play with this quite a bit. You know, you can build all sorts of expectations. And then you can even get to, like, the surreal humor, which is, you know, two ducks are floating on a pond and one says, "Quack." And the other says, "I was going to say that." just one of those things. I don't know what kind of expectation you're building, but whatever that joke is doing, it's playing with
well,
that.
If it involves a duck, there's usually a high expectation of laughter, I think, right?
Yeah, and, you know, this is a tangent, and we can come back to it, but I'll just throw out there that it's been scientifically proven that ducks are the funniest animals.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, okay. But there's controversy because it might be the chicken. It depends on who you ask, but I'll touch on the science behind that because it's a separate topic later.
Okay.
Okay, the other two are a reckoning, which is that moment when you realize that you've made a mistake and you need to turn around. And I guess with your punchline, with the you know, the screwdriver, it comes right towards the end when you realize that it's not about the screwdriver. Or if you're talking about the pajamas joke from Groucho Marx earlier, it's when you realize that maybe Groucho isn't the one wearing pajamas. And then the last part is you've got to resolve it. You've got to have a destination. So in the end, it's constructing, reckoning, and resolving. And so if you don't resolve the joke and you don't have that destination, and here you're talking about lawyer testifies in horse suit, mm-hmm. you've got to have that word horse, because mm-hmm. otherwise lawyer testifies in suit is just weird or ambiguous. So I like to say you've got to have both an intention and you've got to have a place you're going with the humor. And on a more practical side, comedians, I think, fail whenever they don't just try to be themselves. I think when you tell jokes, you're really letting out your most personal self. And so this is kind of like a corollary. Don't try and be someone who you aren't if you're telling a joke, because it just never works.
Right. That's the new style of humor, isn't it? To sort of reflect yourself, talk about yourself, be self-deprecating. And it's more storytelling than that old Henny Youngman style. You mentioned in the book how Lenny Bruce sort of got that started.
Yeah, Lenny Bruce was, I mean, I start my book with Lenny Bruce. Because he wasn't the funniest comedian in the world. He wasn't the most unique, but there was only one Lenny Bruce. Let there be no mistake. He was unusual. And he changed comedy a little bit at the time, one might say forever, in that he would give 2-3 hour rambling dialogues that were comedic, but they included no standard punchlines.
Right.
And his classic Carnegie Hall performance, which everybody should listen to just for cultural awareness, he ends, he says, okay, I'm going to try and tell a joke at the end. And like 17 minutes later, he still hasn't gotten to the punchline, and you wonder if he's even going to remember it. And finally, at the end of his performance, he gives it, and it's okay, but it was the 2 hours before that made it special. And that's kind of a little bit what humor is now, that you've got to tell a story, and if you feel like you're not making a personal connection with the comedian, then it's just not going to work, which is why we have such different tastes in who we find funny and who we don't.
Scott, what do you see in a typical brain when you hook someone up for a scan? And you start telling them jokes or show them, say, a funny TV show, or you watch Seinfeld episodes or something. What does it look like inside the brain?
So not to ruin it, because I know people would love it if I said it looks very clear and you can see this region light up. And this unfortunately is a mis. It's a false perception, because really anytime you give someone, if you give someone a joke and it's written, then you're going to get all sorts of language centers add up, and then frontal lobes trying to figure it out, and they might imagine seeing something, so the visual centers will light up. But if you tease out all these areas by doing careful controls and giving jokes in different forms, you know, visual versus verbal or whatnot, a couple centers seem to be always there and always active when we process jokes. One of them is the anterior cingulate. I talked about that before. That's the part that deals with the conflict, that moment of realizing that you've got some false expectation and you got to fix that. Another, and this is interesting, it's the dopamine production centers are very important. Most people probably have heard of dopamine just because it's a chemical that's involved in a lot in our brains. And it's, to put it simply, it's our reward chemical. So anytime we do something pleasant and our brain wants to give us a reward, we get a little squirt of dopamine in our brains. And you also get it when you eat chocolate and when you do some drugs like cocaine. That's what it taps directly, is it just increases the amount of dopamine available in our brain. So in that way, humor is essentially like a natural high. You're tapping this pleasure center, which has been around since humans have been around. We're just using humor to get at this pleasurable feeling that we like so much in a more natural way.
Scott Weems is our guest. His book is published by Basic Books. It's called Ha, The Science of When We Laugh and Why. And Scott, did you do some of this research while you were at the University of Maryland in studying language?
I did. I should say, you know, the research, I didn't want to come at this topic like as if I've got my own personal belief. I'm really summarizing a lot of very smart people's work.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a cognitive neuroscientist, but I don't want to pretend that most of the studies I'm talking about are the ones done by me. I've done a lot of work on right hemisphere language and creativity, which is certainly related to humor. But the vast majority of the stuff was collected while I was at the University of Maryland, summarizing scientists who I like to think are much smarter than I am.
You actually went on stage and tried stand-up in Baltimore. Would you mind telling us about that experience?
I will if you want me to.
No, just a little bit, say, yeah.
Yeah, when I talk about scientists smarter than me, I was not meant to be a comedian either. I don't know what where my specialty is. But no, I did. I wanted to, for the end of the book, try it. I wanted to go on a stage. Not because I thought I would, you know, be a natural, or that the reading about it would naturally make me a professional comedian. And I'd say anybody that tells you that they're you know, 8-week course or whatever will make you funny, you know, you'd be skeptical of that. So I'm not going to tell you, you know, you're going to be a great comedian after reading my book. But I knew a lot about it, and I know what to practice to get better. And so I went on stage and used my knowledge, and I bombed. I'll be honest about it. I don't want to lie, because this was in Magoobies there in Baltimore.
Oh, yeah.
In the Towson area.
Magoobies Joke House. You worked up some material. How did you do that? Did you try it out on your wife? Did you sit at a typewriter? A typewriter. I just said the word typewriter. Now, that's funny.
I'm old school, but I'm not that old school.
Oh, no, I'm sorry, sir. You sit at your computer and knock out some jokes on a script? How did you do it?
Yeah, basically so. I did. I mean, they've got a great system. I think it's Sunday nights. Even now, they do amateur night, you know, bring people in and sign up with them before. And it's a great – Magoobies is a great club. I feel bad that they had to suffer me that one time. But they're a good club. And so I gave it a shot. I wrote up about a 7-minute bit, I think. I tried to make it personal, which is, you know, what I know works best. And I would say, and who knows, maybe there's someone that was there that would disagree, but I think my jokes were good. I delivered them poorly. Not intentionally. It's just, you know, I practiced, but I practiced with my wife and in a room. And there's a reason. Even Louis C.K., I make myself feel better. Louis C.K., the first time he went on stage, didn't go back, I think, for 2 years. He was that bad, he said. It's like anything else. They call it the rule of five P's. To get good at any sort of art like that, you need to practice and mm-hmm. practice and practice and practice and practice.
So did you come to appreciate about those who do it well?
There was a wonderful feeling of doing it. That there were moments. There's actually a psychologist, Michele Csikszentmihalyi, I think he said, where he calls it flow, where you're in the moment, you're feeling every. You basically feel one at the moment, and you're using your knowledge without any sort of conscious awareness of what you're doing. And I had moments of that as I was getting, you know, a few laughs here and there. It felt good. I can see why people seek it out.
Mm-hmm.
And I was also just reminded that the good news is you don't have to be a professional comedian to make humor a big part of your life and see a lot of very important changes. And so I loved it just for the fact that humor was a very big part of my life, just, you know, not only writing the book, but working on that performance, too. And I'm, you know, I'm thankful for that. It was a lot of fun. I wouldn't change anything.
Scott Weems, we're going to listen to another comic, another stand-up, excerpt from a stand-up of a modern comic, not as old school, certainly old school like Henny Youngman. This is a very contemporary comic, Michael Che, C-H-E. Who is a stand-up comic. He writes for Saturday Night Live, and sometimes you see him on The Daily Show.
This is cool because this is like a dream come true for me to do comedy, you know, for so many people, you know. I'm listening to Juicy a lot to get inspired. You're listening to Biggie's Juicy? It's like the greatest song of inspiration ever, you know. It's weird, though. It's not the same song as when I heard it when I was like 12. Because there's a line in there when he goes, Super Nintendo, Sega Genesis. When I was dead broke, man, I couldn't picture this. That's like $300 worth of merchandise. It's not a lot of money, man. I've been dead broke my whole life and I've had a Sega Genesis. I didn't have a Super Nintendo, but I could picture it. It wasn't like... But it's fun, though. It's good because it's, you know, like if I wasn't doing comedy, I don't know what I'd be doing, you know? I don't know what I'd be doing. It wouldn't be good. I would try to get a regular job. It's embarrassing. I have to, like, lie on my resume. You know how humiliating that is? You ever lie so bad on your resume that you can't believe you didn't get the job? You want to go back to Foot Locker, like really Foot Locker? Who the f*** you hire that has 8 years mayoral experience? And a degree in physics. Who is this amazing shoe salesman? I don't have a degree. I didn't even go to college. And I'm glad I didn't because I do this, so I don't have to go to college for this. And all of my friends that went to college are in crazy debt, like real debt. I got a friend that's $80,000 in debt with an English degree. I learned English for free. It was the first thing I learned. And I talk to this dude every day. I understand everything he's saying. He doesn't know a special kind of English. He doesn't talk like the Game of Thrones. It's just regular English. And you know what he does for a living? He teaches English. Because that's the only thing you can do with an English degree. It's a pyramid scheme.
That's a pyramid scheme. That's Michael Che, C-H-E. Some people pronounce it Che, he says, but he was named after Che Guevara. Were you familiar with him by any chance, Scott?
No, yeah. But I definitely have to seek him out now.
Yeah, there's a bunch of his videos online. As I say, he writes and contributes to Saturday Night Live, and occasionally I guess you see him on SNL. You know, one of the really interesting things you deal with in this book, and there's a lot of interesting material in the book, the difference between men and women when it comes to humor and laughter, who laughs more, who tells more jokes, who remembers jokes. Would you unpack that one for us a little bit?
Sure, yeah. I mean, this is a difficult topic just because we're still learning so much about it. It's one of those areas that is underdeveloped, I think, and people are kind of learning more about it now. But we do know some things that, for example, women laugh more than men. I don't know if you would have guessed that or not, but and we know because actually a University of Maryland, Baltimore campus researcher, Robert Provine, actually went out and eavesdropped on people. Him and his assistant spent a year and just went to subways and coffee shops and counted laughter. And it turns out that if you have two women in a room, they'll probably be about twice as likely to laugh as two men, which is interesting, I think. And I don't know if anybody would have guessed that. But at the
I'm telling you, I'm a little surprised to hear that. But now in reflecting on it, once I read this, reflecting on it does seem to be my experience that that is the case. And we had we had Robert Provine on the show once talking about various behaviors, and that laughter was one of them. And now it comes back to me that he did make the same observation. But what do you make of that?
Yeah, what do you make of that? Well, I mean, I think there's a second fact which you need to combine to get at it better. Is if you look at the world of professional comedy, women are terribly underrepresented. Somebody actually measured, and it might be about 12% now, which sounds bad, but it used to be only like 30 years ago. So it's rising, but still, you know, some of the top comedians now, Amy Schumer, Tina Fey, there are far more men in professional comedy than women. And so people have tried to put together theories why that might be. And it might be that men are raised for some reason to be performers. So we are just naturally trying to get those around us to laugh. And women are more likely to produce the laughter to show, you know, I think he's funny kind of thing. There's been some great feminist literature on the tragedy of that women are not raised to be outspoken and to be the joke tellers. In fact, if you ask there's a great book, it's called Pretend the World is Funny Forever. And they just asked tons of professional comedians, you know, why did you get into it? And the one thing they said is, I wanted to be loud. I wanted to be heard. I want to be outspoken. And I think you need to raise people to be loud, to be outspoken, to have this desire to be heard. That's the one thing that comedians all have. And I think this comes from birth. People need to be raised. And maybe in 10 or 20 years, there will be generations where men and women are basically raised equally on that value. And I don't know. This is just, that's one theory though. And I don't know if I fully buy it.
What do you make of the personality of stand-up comics, the men who dominate? I'm thinking Tears of the Clown here, because we hear a lot of stories about these people being very funny on stage, but very morose, sullen, even depressed off stage. I've known a couple of stand-up comedians who've, talked about that.
Yeah, people ask me sometimes, what's the biggest bad news you have about humor, or what's the thing that surprised you the most? And this is it, that it turns out that if you look at what personality characteristics, so you give people personality tests, funny people versus people who don't include humor in their life so much. And it turns out the thing that differentiates funny people is neuroticism. And I'm not talking about pathology. I mean that we're all somewhere on a spectrum. You know, nobody's fully stable or fully unstable. We're all somewhere in between. Granted, if you get to a certain degree, that's, when diagnoses come in. But I'm not talking about diagnoses. I'm talking about just we're all somewhere along that spectrum. And it turns out that those of us who are less just completely stable people tend to have higher senses of humor. They tend to be professional comedians, and not just comedians, but other professions too. Very likely my favorite academic study of all time looked at professions, everything from physicists to Nigerian veterinary surgeons. I'm not making that up. And gave them personality tests. And it turned out most all the cases, neuroticism was the thing. That's what makes you very successful in your job, which to some degree just means you need to be a little bit risk-taking in life, which might not be all bad. I would say that if you don't take some risks and you don't put yourself out there a little bit, then not only you're not going to be a professional comedian, you might be, shortcoming yourself in other ways. I think the trick is just not to go, as with anything, it's to not go too far.
You're listening to Midday. Dan Roderick's here speaking with Scott Weems, a neuroscientist and author of a serious book about a funny subject entitled Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why, available from Basic Books. His theory is that humor is a natural response to conflict and confusion in our brain, and that under the right circumstances, almost anything can make us laugh. A short break. We'll be right back for more Midday. Hey, welcome back. Talking about humor in this hour with neuroscientist Scott Weems. There aren't as many female comics as there are male comics. Of course, we were just talking about that. But here's one probably known to our NPR audience pretty well, Tig Notaro, a little excerpt from one of her routines.
I travel everywhere, and I've noticed over the past year or two that these signs are popping up at public pools stating that you cannot go swimming if you have diarrhea. And it makes sense. I understand. It's a, you know, there's disease. But who, what kind of person is that comfortable with themselves to where they're like, oh man, not feeling very well today. Doctor said I should probably stay home. But you know what? I'm gonna head down to the public pool, go do some laps. Really, how comfortable do you have to be to just be doing the backstroke with full-on diarrhea? They're like, hey, out of the pool. You can't swim with diarrhea. How am I supposed, I can't swim. How am I supposed to know this? Yeah, out, you cannot swim. If you don't want me swimming with diarrhea, you're gonna have to put a sign up. Because there is no way. There's no way to know.
Take Notaro. I hope you enjoyed that. Scott Weems, what's going on there in her storytelling? How would you analyze the funny in Tig Notaro's story right there?
Oh, my. So the first thing I would do is I'd call upon the classic A.B. White line who said, you know, dissecting humor is like dissecting frogs.
Mm-hmm.
The subject is always killed in the end.
Yeah, right.
And so I'll do it a little bit, I guess. But, I mean, to some extent, there's a little bit of grace that's lost when you dissect diarrhea humor, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
One thing about that grabs me is that she's touching on a topic that we don't typically find appropriate to talk about.
Right, right.
And there's a saying that if you want to make a point, you tell a story. But if you want to make many points at once, you tell a joke. And so I don't know if she's doing it here. Usually there's a more subtle point when you're telling a joke. I don't think that would be as funny, first, if she didn't deliver it well. And second, if there weren't some sort of conflict that we feel about talking about diarrhea in public pools. It's just something that's grossly inappropriate. I think, frankly, it's even funnier coming from her because she's just got a great delivery of voice and she sounds kind of, I don't know, innocent, I guess. I don't know how to say
well,
it. There's no rancor in it. It's almost
right.
An amusement.
It is.
It.
I think isn't she having the same reaction a lot of us do if we see such a sign and wonder, why on earth did they have to put a sign like that up?
Yeah,
right?
I don't think that's funny. Well, maybe Lewis Black could make it work, but probably not. I think it would just come across as angry. And
right.
So, yeah, I like that.
And the stupid, yeah, a stupid sign, where
yeah.
she broke it down and made a story out of it.
Yeah, and a personal one. Yeah,
yeah. Let's move on here. I had a couple more questions for you about jokes and humor and how it works in different parts of the world, different parts of the country, even. But in terms of how people respond to jokes, what they respond to, the research has found some difference in people of different ethnic groups and different nationalities.
Yeah, there are. I mean, anytime you talk about nationalities or genders or things like that, of course you're generalizing. So just to back up a little bit, I want to make sure I'm not generalizing too much on any group. But you can generalize to some extent, and there are patterns, especially when you're looking at international differences. For example, a very British kind of joke is what's green and has wheels?
I don't know.
Grass. I was lying about the wheels. That's an old
The
joke,
British but. Like that joke.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
They like the awkward and just absurd humor. This and there have been personality tests that have seen this. Americans like their humor a little bit more direct and confrontational, which maybe, I mean, you can read into that as you may. It may be a sign of our own personal, you know, society, how we are. I mean, British, there's a long tradition of the stiff upper lip, you know, not showing that emotion. And so you could see a lot of interesting things. And to bring it back, go full circle, the studies that looked at that are also the ones that looked at the duck versus chicken controversy I mentioned before.
Yes.
Richard Wiseman was a psychologist, and he basically set up a website and let people from all over the world judge their favorite jokes. And by doing this, he was able to see British versus American taste. And he was also able to make subtle manipulations, for example, telling the same joke with a horse versus a duck as the protagonist. And it turns out duck is funnier. Mel Brooks thought chicken was funny.
Hmm.
And But it turns out if you do it experimentally, you see the duck is. Supposedly it's because the hard consonants are funniest. I don't know why hard consonants are funny. But if you have a choice of having a talking duck or a talking horse, make it the duck.
For the longest time, I think when maybe Monty Python was on television, the Monty Python TV show appeared on American TV way back in the 70s, Americans would scratch their heads and say, why is that so funny? What is it about British humor? Or they'd make a reference to British humor as some odd thing that Americans didn't get. So I just wonder if you thought about that and what distinguishes it. Is it just more sophisticated, more cerebral?
Well, I think there's a long social tradition there. I don't think Americans could pull off something like Fawlty Towers, the classic John Cleese show that I love so much. You'll never see that for an American audience. It's just not something that we're used to seeing. So I don't know if it really is much more than one of those learned things. I think when you look at things like national differences or even gender differences, it's just way people are raised a lot of the time. And there is a long tradition of the British stiff upper lip where they're not going to give a joke, the classic American joke. I'm not a professional joke teller, but a Harvard graduate and a Texan meet, and the Texan says, where are you from? And the Harvard graduate says, I'm from someplace where we don't finish our sentences with prepositions. And the Texan goes, okay, where are you from, jackass? I hope I was allowed to say that joke.
It's fine. No, that's a great American joke. That's a great American joke.
Yeah, that's a very American joke. And that is the kind of interaction we're surrounded by all the time. I do a lot of self-monitoring on jokes. Hopefully that was okay.
But no, that's fine. Yeah.
And in American culture, this is just something you would say to each other.
Right.
I don't think you would say that in Britain. It's just not something that's done.
No. Here's a joke that's popular in Europe, according to your book, Scott. A Labrador Retriever walks into a Western Union office and says he wants to send a telegram. The clerk hands him a form, and the dog writes down, woof, 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 woof. The clerk looks at it and says, there's 9 woofs here. You can send another woof for the same price. Sure, the dog says, but that wouldn't make any sense. So that's popular in
my favorite joke right there.
Is it really?
I love that one.
You like that one?
Yeah, I love that one.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was actually included in that test of international humor taste, and that was up there. That was almost a winner.
I like Henny Youngman. So I can't pick out a single Henny Youngman joke because there's so many of them, they fly by so quickly. Part of the fun of his routines and those old-style comics was the rapid-fire nature of them. Same with Robin Williams. You really didn't have time to think. You were just sort of responding to these quick jokes, quick laughter.
And just to throw out there, if anybody, Google Mitch Hedberg duck joke.
Mitch?
If any listeners
say it again,
have access.
Mitch?
Mitch Hedberg duck joke.
Okay.
I would say that might be the funniest joke in the world, too, but he'd have to deliver it, so I just say people should Google it later.
You made reference to Richard Weissman. He had his famous Laugh Lab project, right, to find the world's funniest joke.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we actually gave that away on a show here a few weeks ago. And I don't mind. We could save that to the end of the hour and share that with folks. In the meantime, Scott, I have a question for you from one of our listeners, Alice, by email. She says, I have found myself overwhelmed with emotion when listening to music. Usually it is a classical piece, and often it's in person, such as a concert. The usual emotion leans toward crying. However, when my son was 6, I took him to see the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra. At one point, he was overcome with the inclination to giggle during the music, and he wouldn't stop. Later, when I asked him about it, he said he didn't want to laugh, but the music was making him feel like laughing, not because it was funny, but because it, quote, tickled inside my head. Is there any research, are there any observations about uncontrollable laughter and a possible connection to music?
There is. I love that story, and it really touches on something that's both important and beautiful. That is true. The same regions responsible for that feeling, that chills down the spine feeling you get when you hear emotionally moving music, is the same one you get with humor. These dopamine areas I talked about before, the pleasure center of the brain. And we know that because scientists have basically explicitly done that. They've taken people who live in the world of music, either musicians or producers, and asked them to identify those pieces of music which moved them so much it gave them chills, and monitored their brains. What parts of the brain are active that are causing these chills? And it turns out that if you do that, and then you do, like, separately, you have people watch episodes of Mr. Bean, to go British again. American audiences might not know Mr. Bean, which is a shame, but it's a very British comedian who's very visual humor. He very seldom talks, if at all. But the good thing about using a clip like that is he's like the visual analog of music. There's no language you got to deal with. It's just something you watch. And the same areas light up. It's the same dopamine-producing centers. And so I think what's happening is Freud, actually, I can't believe I'm mentioning Freud, but I'll mention he had a term he called it cathexis, which is the opposite of catharsis. Catharsis is the washing away of emotions, but this isn't what we do when we process a joke or hear moving music. It's the opposite of that. It's when you're getting many different emotions at once. Joy or fear and happiness, all of these things. Very, very little in life is emotionally simple. Most of it is quite complex, and cathexis is what we use to describe these moments when sometimes we laugh when we don't mean to, or maybe we cry when we're not really sad. It's just so emotionally moving, and humor taps that that region, which I absolutely love.
I touched on this early in the show. It seems almost like a cliche because you hear it so much, that laughter is good medicine, that it's actually been scientifically proven to be good for one's health. Where do you come down on that, Scott?
It is, and it's amazing the research that's been done on this that we might not be familiar with, but I mean, I think you said it in the show's opening that humor, and I don't mean being a professional comedian, I mean just sitting down and watching a comedy, has been shown to increase pain tolerance. It increases our cardiovascular health. This is another Maryland researcher, Michael Miller, I believe, who looked and saw it increases what's called vasoreactivity, which means it makes our blood vessels more pliable. It increases immune system response. So many different things humor does. So much better than just like resting or these other things. Okay. And so I'd say humor is a very big important part of the health. I would never say that you shouldn't also take medicine too. So there have been people who've tried to laugh themselves out of diseases, and Norman Cousins is a famous example. And I would say this is great. Just as stress has negative impacts on the body, so does humor have very important positive ones. Just always mix that with a good dose of penicillin if that's what's called for. And I think that's the best response to keeping healthy that you can get.
Here's the world's funniest joke, according to Richard Weissman's Laugh Lab. Two hunters are out in the woods when one of them collapses. He's not breathing and his eyes are glazed. So his friend calls 911 and says, "My friend is dead. What should I do?" The dispatcher replies, "Calm down, sir. I can help. First, let's make sure he's dead." There's a silence, then a loud bang. Back on the phone, the guy says, "Okay, now what?" All right. I hope that's some good medicine for you. You get a little chuckle out of that. Scott, thank you very much for being on our show today, and congratulations on your first book.
Oh, thank you. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, Scott Weems, who was at the University of Maryland, College Park, now living in Arkansas. His book, Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why, published by Basic Books. I hope you enjoyed the program. Dan Rodrigues here saying have a great afternoon. See you again soon.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The associate producer, Michael Himowitz. Our interns are Brian Gilbert, Tyler Downey, Anna Muckerman, and Evelyn Feeney. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at wypr.org. Dan Rodrick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.